Mr. James, rail 26. So how often would these planes come over?
Oh, they were every day, and you didn't know when they'd daylight suddenly come into view. They were so, I mean, this we must have been about, in those days, about 400 miles an hour. But they'd come flying low, you couldn't look above us. And suddenly they'd open the bridge and they're on you. And they were grey, black crosses, square with cut wings at the air, and you hate them, it's Gert and Daisy. Two of them.
They're always worked in twos.
Two together, Gert and Daisy. And we call them Gert and Daisy. And it was a fate of my life, because I was sent back once, about 60 miles back, to the third end of the truck, to get an urgent assignment of mines wanted by the Royal Engineers, and they sent me back 60 miles in this coach truck with two men sitting on top of the drivers with their legs dangling over the screen. And they were told that if they saw Gert and Daisy, they would have and stop, and we'd dive into a cover if it was whatever. Hopefully, we'll see Gert and Daisy, but now God. We went, we got back to this place about 60 miles back, where the dump was, and came back to this third of a chock a block of mines. And he'd left sitting there, and I sit beside the driver. And they came, down they came, shooting away. Everybody sat on top, did that. The driver put his hand on straight away. They were flying through the air, about 20, 30 feet in front of us, and landed on their backsides. How they were killed, I don't know. How they weren't killed, I don't know. But we all died out, and in the car. And they were shooting us up. It was the bloody truck. And away they went. We got back in, we thought, well, we shan't see them for another hour or two, and hopefully we would see them again. But we saw them twice. We got through with the mines. That was the most terrifying experience of my life. Because Gert and Daisy, I was terrified of them. And a bloody lot of the mines was worse. They were, I would grant, show me some on foot normally, but on this occasion, we had to do it.
And who ordered you to get these mines? Can you remember?
Well, there was a base behind. I forget the name of the place.
No, but who ordered you to? Who? Can you remember who gave you the orders?
They were urgent to leave it because there was an expected an attack.
But who was it ordered them? Who was it ordered you?
Presumably Colonel Dickie Ware. Dickie Ware, presumably. He was our command officer at the time.
Did you see anything of Ware?
Yes, he was a nice chap. He was well liked.
But what was he actually doing at this stage? In January.
He was in the front line. He was the first World War experienced officer.
Yeah, but what was he actually doing here at this stage?
Oh, it was all sacking stuff. But we were expecting at one time, or somebody discovered that there was a weakness. You know, in this position, and it needed mines. And this is why I had to go and get the bloody mines quick, because we did expect all the signs were that we could well have an end to this stalemate.
Now, going back to the German aircraft, can you remember any kind of, I mean, what did you feel about the fact that the RAF weren't there in any great numbers?
I secretly cursed the RAF. I wondered where the hell they were. I wondered, well, damn, we didn't mind. They were near to us nearby. They never came out and did battle. They had control of Nigeria when they fought in Tunis.
So how often would Gert and Daisy come over?
Oh, all day. On the hour. Every half hour sometimes. They were the damn nuisance.
So
and they would cover the hole. They would cover the hole on the Tunisian front line. And they'd probably go from one end to the other and shoot everything up that we saw.
And were these always fighter aircraft? They were always
two Messerschmitts. Messerschmitts. Anyway, one day one day, we saw them going along, and I did a bloody post on, and I was with an officer, and I said, I've got trace in my, I said, I'm going to shoot the trace of bullet and see if I can hit the bugger. And I shot at the trace of bullet went straight, and I aimed in front of him, and he went right into one, and this officer said, you hit the bugger.
This is with a rifle.
And trace of bullet. And they went through, they were just in that range. You know what? I must have hit it, bloody. Because 10 minutes later, three or four of them came. There we were. Ooh, shooting us up and dropping bloody bombs. And we could see these bombs dropping down like when we saw them leaving the planes. Like little marbles, pellets, and they came down. Ooh! We thought bloody run away, you know, away from them where we were. But they knew where we were, and my trace of bullet had done it. And I always think that the reason I did it was because I hit somebody.
And where were you at this stage? This is in Vietnam.
Oh, it was in the Sardinian area. It was during the day when I felt like it.
Did you not have the in England you had the anti-aircraft platoon. Was there no...
Well, the anti-aircraft kept silent. And I lived so fast. And no.
You mentioned the Bofors guns then.
Oh, yeah, the Bofors guns were each side of the tobacco factory.
And how many of those were there?
Only one, each side.
One gun per...
One gun each side. Mm. And two men per gun. I mean, they were there.
And did they
were nice men. They were from Bradford, they were. I was talking to them, you know. my God. I must have ruined all my story. But they really did bloody well. Boom, the time came. When we were really attacked, which is another story which I shall relate to you about such a day of dive bombing, when I lost my hearing.
So at this stage, you would only just see, you would hardly see the RAF.
On this day, we didn't see them at all. No, we didn't see the RAF at all. The odd Spitfire going slowly. Oh, once every month. We were lucky to see a Spitfire. We didn't see any British bloody airplanes at all.
What about your, were these German aircraft accurate? Did you see any British installations? Or we will get to the story of the tobacco factory, but before this, did you notice, were they effective?
And they were so effective that nothing dare show itself during daylight.
So there's no
nowhere.
There's no movement between yourselves and
to Green Hill. I can assure you, no movement anywhere during the day. And if they saw anything, they had complete mastery over that area, the jetties. If they saw anything, they probably waved you back as well. Well, I mean, the same, you know. I mean, so far as the bombing of Central Davis was there, that's all done by Stukas.
Yeah. Now, you're doing the Russian run every night up to the positions in front of Greenhill. Did you notice any change in the attitude of D Company over the few weeks that they're in front?
I've got stories. I've got all the information. I didn't lack anything.
So what came back?
Commanders used to be going through, but they can't agree that the day commanders went through when they wanted to take a prisoner. They were told to take a prisoner. There were dead bodies still not far ahead of C Company lines, booby trapped with wires, rotting. There were guardsmen who had been there for a long time, and they dared touch them because there were booby traps everywhere. And as I say, the Jerrys didn't make any patrol sound, but the British did. And I know that D Company and all companies sent a patrol, but very far ahead. I mean, there was some rising ground before we got to Green Hill and Baldy, but Oh yes, we set the poles out and the A-ball still sort of bring back a jelly. And especially the commanders there, they again, I don't know, but they were frequently coming from the line, you told commands coming through. And you see that bloody brave bastard, the green bellies going up, you know, black faces.
Did they stand out then, as a unit? They stood out with their green berets and.
They had their commander there indeed. Commander, you respected them for what they did because they were fearless, you know. And they had their casualties as well.
Did you do you remember news of the first casualties that the battalion had or the company
yes,
had?
Oh, I remember. Yes. One of the early casualties was Private Byron. He was a tall, smart kid, he was. A Blitz. I named him now, but I hope that I don't know. I hope I don't sort of cause any sadness to anybody who in the future might hear these notes and relate it to these people. But Pletz wanted to do his business, and he got in his haunches with crap, and he was shot in the backside, a sniper. And he had a very first casualty.
That was the first D company. At this stage, can you remember any German prisoners at all in Saguenay? Can you remember anybody coming back through the lines?
No, I don't think, as far as I remember, I don't think they captured a Jerry. They were up there commanding, maybe they were sort of under there. They were up there at commanding house. They could see everywhere. And they also had snipers. And I remember the story, I mean, they used to tell me the stories that you couldn't find it by the sniper. They'd shoot, they fired it at you, and you'd look at them with two binoculars for them. But what he had on him, he had a bloody dirty camouflage cape on his head. And his snapping rifle with sights. And he merely removed his hood and threw his sights, he popped far. And then he put the guy, pulled him down again, you couldn't see him. He was an irregular, he blended into the countryside, an irregular ragged figure.
And
he told you.
So
you only see people if you were clever, but they were not with you. Some of them were caught, but you know, some of them were spotted and got it.
So during these, you had the regular ration run every night.
Every night.
And then you told me off the tape the story of the tobacco bag factory being bombed. If you could. About that.
Right, but no, that was to say, so that we went on every night up there these evening meals, and I used to sort of spend an hour or two up there, and I would walk around, and it must have lasted about 5 or 6 weeks. We went into the line, I think, and see now. We arrived at, as you said, must go into the line about middle of January, 15th or 16th of January, roughly. And my mother's birthday was on the 2nd of February, when I was in this Saguenay tobacco factory. And on the 3rd of February, which was the morning after, everybody, someone went down from Queen and Double, because they were lousy.
This was D Company?
D Company. They were lousy.
That was the entire company?
Yeah. And they'd been had, I think one blanket is the blanket in the night, and rolling it up the next morning, and then the next day they have a different blanket. But anyway, water was at a premium there. They couldn't, and they still had their bloody battle dress. For the English glory, believe it or not. But can you imagine being in the front line with all the dust and dirt and not having a wash? It only needed one blouse, That's what I believe. That really happened. Everybody was lousy. They had their khaki woolen shirts still on. If you take a shirt off, the thick seam up the back would have hundreds of lice and eggs under the arms of the seam. Whenever there were seams and sweat, so were the lice of the eggs. Anyway, I was lousy. I caught the buggers. I was lousy. Now, I, as a CKMS, was given my bird Newman a great big tin, 18 inches tall, by about a foot square, of carbonic anti-louse powder. It was called AL63. I put salmonella in my balls and I jumped the wire. Well, I'm doing my bloody stuff. I went to the doctor, he laughed his head off. He said, you see, he said, balls are sweaty. He said, you'll be all right. You know, if they want best and drop off. Anyway, that was the result. With me, having the time and the facilities as well, I took my shirt off. And I used to smoke in those days, and I used to have my cigarette lighter, get the flame up, and I'd go right up the seam of my back shirt, and I'd bloody pop them off, all these lice. I wouldn't be long enough to burn the shirt. I'd be going up, but I'd burn the lice and swell them up and burst them. And go, right up, and I'd get rid of the bloody lot with my cigarette lighter flame. Under the arms as well. Oh, I remember I took the A63 and had all no fear. Then one cigarette lighter up the shirt. And that's what I did. But anyway, they came in the morning. We were told on the 3rd of February, anyway, at 9 o'clock, the MO would be there to denounce the whole of the company. I had drank a bottle of gin the night before, but you'd had my mother's birthday the 2nd. And I said, yeah, I'm out of there. I'm really good drink. Bottle of gin. The night before, believe it or not.
And who were you with?
Yeah. Oh, Archie Mescalitely and one or two other two blokes. And we were waiting for the following morning at 9 o'clock for denouncing this company. They were told to be on parade at 9 o'clock sharp. I did breakfast was about 7:30. 9 o'clock, they were 10 to 9 and all there. Sergeant Battle said, he said, Jimmy, he said, there'd be a bloody stick of bombs along this side. He said, we're so vulnerable. He said, there's an old soldier here. There'd be a stick of bombs coming along there. He said, there'd be one that won't hit us. I said, don't sit on a plastic symbol. He hardly said it when the whistles blew. That was a signal. If there were aircraft, whistles, our army whistles were blowing all over the bloody place. And suddenly, we were told, if there's any aircraft coming over, a danger of attack, troops must remain within the buildings and not show themselves outside. Let them think the place was empty.
And who said that?
Major Mandelman, second in command. That was his orders. And everybody was told, this is what we had to do. So I was standing in the middle of the tobacco factory with all these troops. I said, right, around the perimeter. Everybody dash to the edge of the buildings, around the perimeter, all the way around. Leaving the centre empty. I was sitting at the very centre with the RKMS. Too late. I had to get down there because the bombs started falling. Wheeling, moaning, screaming, Stukas going around and round in a circle like eagles. Screaming, and then suddenly one would come down, one by one, dead down on the buildings. As they came down, they were firing everything they had, and we were the part we knew we were because the corrugated iron roof. Looked up, and I was in the middle of the floor of the RPMS, and we saw thousands of daylight holes appearing in the bloody corrugated iron roof, and the bullets were bouncing above the concrete. Most of the troops were around the perimeter inside the building, and not a soul left the building. That was a discipline. One bloody bomb came down, and the old ACAG outside, both hands, boom, 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 boom. non-stop. Must be firing right into the eyeballs of the German pilots. And they stood their ground and they were very vulnerable in that attack, just were. But non-stop. Boom, 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 you know. And still the bloody bullets didn't come. Boom! One bomb. I counted 13 bombs all around. They were put up with these attack guns, deviated a little bit, but still the bullets, as they came down from a height, were coming through until eventually the whole of the bloody roof was daylight. And we weren't hit. I was so frightened that I scraped the concrete, trying to get under the bloody thing with my nails. It made my fingers bleed. That was the terror. And it had sound like warning. And suddenly, no more sound, nothing. Instant, whoosh, blackness. No sound, didn't hear it. Bloody bomb dropped so near. They say that if you have a shell or a bomb, you wouldn't hear it. We didn't hear it. Instant blackness and dead silence. That's number 14 bomb. And the last one I counted. So there were 14 Stukas. Dead silence, pitch blackness, and I thought I'm dead. So I felt my body warm. No, I'm not. And I got on my knees. And I knew the RKS was there, but there were all these lads still around the perimeter, and there was dead silence. I said, "Are you there, RQ?" I just called him RQ. He said, "Yes, Jimmy." He said, "I think we've met it." So I said, "No, we're not. I'm on my knees." I knew what he was, and I remember where he was. He said, "Are you?" He said, "Reach out." He said, "As we, our hands met," and he said, "Now let's give up." He said, "Now for Christ's sake, walk slowly, Jimmy." Now he was a mature chap. He was, Archimedes, politely. He was a mature chap. Must have been in middle 40s. And he said, "Let's take small steps," he said. He says, "I don't know what the hell this bloody blackness is," but we took small steps and we're in the smoke cloud of the bomb and the contact cloud of the bomb, and it was pitch black. And this lovely sunny North African morning, you know, the sun had gone. And we walked through, oh, we took this bloody smoke cloud, must have been many feet in diameter. And we stepped out of it, like stepping through a wall, in the blinding sunlight, and looked back and saw it. And we looked at each other, and we were covered like flower men. Absolutely. Eye cases, eyelashes, eyebrows, any bloody thing. We were absolutely covered in the white dust. Called out. And we looked at each other, and we looked. There were 9 dead men. Just there. And the bomb dropped where they were. One of his guts revealed himself. One of the black bullets in his chin. One in his forehead. And I recognized them. They were sympathists. The name had just come to me. The one, Johnson, was one. A chap who was a dark fella. And he was one. But one of the first that I recognized. So, from nowhere came a general, Dolly Medico, and he saw me, and the RKS, and he says, and he could see my badge of rank at the time, CQS, and he said, "You had a narrow scrape, are you all right?" Well, the shock hadn't set in. I said, "Yes, I think so." Saluted him. And the salute was a bloody cloud of dust. And the RKS backed off and started running towards Bert Newman's place was. To tell Bert Newman, I suppose.
And where was Bert Newman at this point?
What happened was, while the RKS went down to towards the quartermaster's the Roman Catholic Padre, who was a young, beefy-faced Irishman, appeared on the scene. And he looked at me, and he looked at the dead, and he knelt down, and he gave them the last rites. And Bert Newman turned up, the quartermaster. And the party turned round and says, "Quartermaster, can you please get me 9 blankets? I want to bury the dead." He says, "Certainly not." He said, "The blankets are for the living, not the dead." "Where did you get that idea from, Padre?" And the Padre turned and he said, "You're a heartless man." And Bert Newman walked away. Never got men.
And the aftermath of this anyway, attack.
Anyway. As soon as this is what again, and everybody started to panic, because I was not a lot. And everybody started to rush. And I ran away. I jumped into a bloody great big cactus bush. And that thorns about 4 inches long. Oh, God, that was stupid thing to do. That would have been panic. And it was merely one lone aircraft probably taking a photograph. Of the result. Now, considering the poor stupid, we were lucky to run away with the pandemic.
And that was the heaviest attack that you witnessed?
That you was involved in. The terrible thing. I lost my hearing. I didn't know it at the time. But it blew out my right ear. And I busted the eardrum.
And what did you feel about Bert Newman's reaction to that at the time?
Well,
what did you think?
Well, I had to keep a tongue in my cheek, but he was really so immune, so cold, so heartless, so unconcerned that I was shocked.
But you said earlier that he had First World War medals, so maybe he had an experience of the First World War.
Well, of course, really speaking, I suppose, if you give every dead man a blanket, it should be the left blankets. I mean, nowadays they're wiser. They've got bloody polythene bags or something, or God knows what. But anyway, we bury those dead men as they were. In their uniforms and boots and everything else. We buried them there and there. Yards from where they lay. There, beside Mr. McAvanky. Started to dig graves and buried them. And they were 6 foot down as well. And next we left that bloody place, and next we over the woods, we went across the river, and even watching it into the woods for the rest of the day and night, and from there on.
So that's, in terms of the men that you like followed Bert Newman's example, really, after that event?
Right. Incidentally, there was no delousing. It was all cancelled, you know. And that was the end of that. So everyone was still lousy. And we all went over the woods. The next morning, somebody went over to have a look, and all the dead men had been dug up by Arabs, left naked, with their clothes stolen and their boots taken, and everything. They were left naked on top of the graves. So they thought, "You bastards, doing that." They dug up that hole of the mine and pinched the blood. Bloods of uniforms and everything, every vestige of everything, making naked upon